As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Total Soccer Show and our review of this week's Champions League round of 16 first leg ties, in which Porto got out their claws, Inter made Atleti pause, and the other two games were delicately poised draws. My name's Ryan Bailey, joining me today to talk all things continental action, Taylor Rockwell. Hello.
Hello, I'm excited to be here.
Likewise, buddy. Also joining us, Graham Ruthven. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ryan. How are you? Excited to talk about four mediocre to boring matches today?
I didn't want to start off with that, Graham, but I did want to follow up with four games that made Graham say, I can't wait. I'm excited to make Graham end up being enthusiastic about these.
Yeah, it's going to be a great episode.
When you went to podcasting school, did they tell you to try not to get the listeners to listen to the rest of the episode within the first minute?
I missed that class at school. No.
These were captivating ties, Joe Lowry, right?
Oh, absolutely. I love these games. I love them so much. When I went to podcasting school, they said to use a monotone voice to convince the audience and that what you're saying you really believe, and that's what I'm doing right now.
Yay. Definitely have the tone of a hostage reading a prepared statement.
Yeah, no, Barcelona was great. Xavi's decision to push Andres Christensen not just to the number six role, but to the number eight role made a ton of sense to me, and I agree with every single part of it.
Wonderful. Save that goal for later, Joseph. That's my advice. Right now, we've got to dig into a video that Graham found and he shared amongst our group of Finland's Eurovision entry, which is by someone called Windows 95 Guy, who is dressed in Windows 95 clothing, Graham.
I thought you'd be a big fan, Ryan, given the 90s nostalgia in this video, no? Is this not the sort of 90s nostalgia you're into?
You're telling me I'm a big fan of Microsoft, Mr. Apple over here. Is that what you're saying?
That's true, of course, yeah. Yeah, no, apologies. That was an oversight. Yeah, it's an interesting, even by Eurovision standards, it's an interesting entry where there's a man dressed in Euro 95 hat and shirt and nothing else, almost. He's wearing underwear.
You're not gonna lead with the fact that he hatches out of an egg to begin the performance? Come on,
there's so many things to describe, Taylor. I forgot about that. Yes, it's all over the place. Go and look it up on the YouTube if you care to watch it.
I think happily do a Eurovision watch along with you four, certainly with Graham. I would love to just drag Joe into it, knowing that he has a billion other things that he would rather be doing, and yet still make him try to comprehend and understand what Eurovision is and how glorious it truly is. I feel like by the end, he'd get Stockholm Syndrome and be into it.
Yeah, I can see myself slipping into loving Eurovision very, very quickly, which is why I haven't allowed myself to do it yet. Yep. But you all are dragging me in slowly.
It's interesting, Joe, because obviously there's the spectacle of the songs, which are almost always ridiculous, but then you have the voting. So the voting where other nations vote for their favorites, and you'll be looking for the metrics and the techniques they're using to reach their voting decisions. Then you just realize it's just the countries that like each other vote for them, and then the ones who hate each other.
And Australia are in it for some reason.
And Australia's in it, which is great. Anyway,
we can blame England for that. I'm like 99.9% sure we can blame England.
Somewhere back down the line, we certainly can do, Joseph. Yeah, we can indeed. Yep. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you enjoy us talking nonsense about Eurovision and other stuff. And thank you very much to everybody who supports us via our Patreon, where there are bonus episodes, there are bonus videos, and access to our Discord gang. Graham, we'll get back to these Champions League games that we're going to talk about in this episode. Like,
you're really stalling here.
Yeah, right? But they first, the weather.
they weren't that bad, right?
No,
I mean, they were not.
They weren't outrageously bad. I think we can agree, though, that the Champions League hasn't quite lit up this season. I feel like we're waiting for the quarterfinals. And to be honest, I'm not sure there's a grand statement to make about the Champions League. I've seen some think pieces about this is what the Champions League has become and we need the Swiss format to come in and change it. I think it's just some bad draws, to be honest. I remember when the draws came out of the hat at the end of last year, and I kind of had a sigh because it feels like there's a favourite, a clear favourite in most ties, and that's kind of panned out with the exception of Lazio and Bayern Munich. I think that is the positive side of it, is most of the ties are still largely up for grabs. You'd say Manchester City, Copenhagen is the only one that's a foregone conclusion going into the second leg. But I also feel like people have forgotten that this is what Champions League knockout matches tend to be like. We've been spoiled in the last couple of years by the Qatar World Cup and AFCON, which had, you know, incredible dramatic moments. And then even the Premier League this season. So this is what the Champions League is. And in a weird way, I take some sadistic enjoyment from like a tight, cagey, tense Champions League knockout match. And we got a few of those in this round.
We did indeed. Why don't we start off at the San Siro with a Kanye West in attendance? Great. Inter Milan 1, Atletico Madrid 0. I imagine sort of, I'm putting on my Bane voice now, Graham, and Inter Milan looking at Atleti and saying, you think you're the poop house? I was born in the poop house. It was some interesting stuff going on here. Substitute Marko Arnautović scoring the only goal, a rebound from a Lautaro shot.
What a world. In 2024, yeah. Marko Arnautović is scoring goals in Champions League knockout games. Not something that I expected.
Stoke legend Marko Arnautović getting in on the Champions League action. Yeah, I do indeed. Were, Graham, Inter the better side overall? Better chances here, probably fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think the overview of this match was it wasn't the most exhilarating of matches, but I do think there was enough to hold the interest. And I also think, to my earlier point, I think there is a weight to big, important knockout matches like this where goals feel really significant. There was a point in the second half where it felt like Atleti were the ones handling the tie a little bit better. That's not to say they were creating lots of opportunities. It was just that they were playing the sort of game that we've seen so many times from Simeone in the Champions League. It wasn't classic Cholo ball in that Atleti were willing to play an open game at times, and there were moments where Inter were able to get in behind. But Inter's momentum at that point appeared to have gone early in the second half, and I felt pretty good about Atleti's chances at that point. But then Arnautović got the winner. He was a real chaos merchant when he came on at halftime. I wouldn't say he has the like natural partnership with Lautaro Martinez that Marcus Thuram does, but he comes off at halftime with an injury. Arnautović at this point in his career, not very refined. I saw after one of his missed chances, you know, at the San Siro, they have that bit they can run into. There's a tier and the fans like rush forward. Mm-hmm. After he missed an opportunity, all the fans rush forward to like give him abuse at the front of the tier. So I don't think he is a particularly popular figure for Inter Milan, but he did put himself in a good position to score a number of times, and he is the one following up Lautaro for the winner. So yeah, I think Inter were the stronger team, particularly in the first half. They certainly created better opportunities. On another night, they maybe take more than just one of them. That might be the regret for them, because Atleti are a different proposition at home. But Atleti make these matches tough, and Inter themselves, you know, they'll make it difficult in the return leg, such as their defensive strength this season. I think I read they've conceded 12 goals this season. Jan Sommer has got something ridiculous like 21 clean sheets in 33 games this season. So I don't think Atleti are going to have a difficult time and have an easy time, excuse me, in the second leg. I kind of predict more of the same in that return game.
Graham, I appreciate all of that. What I don't appreciate is you not defining what you think a chaos merchant is, because to me, at first, it sounds like, oh, Arnautović came in and like really rattled Atleti and seemed to get under their skin. And in reality, I think he caused chaos for like
himself.
Like, yeah, I was going to say, like anybody with a heart condition, maybe he caused chaos for if you're an Inter fan.
Yeah, it's a broad definition, a chaos merchant. Chaos merchant in my mind just means you're not totally in control of everything, but ultimately you are a benefit to the team. So Darwin Nunez is the ultimate chaos merchant right now. I'm not saying Arnautovic is as good as Darwin Nunez, by the way. But no. Arnautovic came on in the second half. Things just seemed to happen around him. I don't know whether that was through his doing, but he did at least have some good opportunities.
I do feel a level of sympathy, which is not a thing I feel comfortable saying about Mark Arnautovic, but some of those chances weren't quite as clear cut as I think people wanted to make them. And I think it is in the moment, it feels like, oh, what could have been? But by the same token, like Lautaro Martinez is a great header, but he puts it more or less right at the goalkeeper, puts it either side. And I think that's a goal. I think Marcus Thuram in the first half had some opportunities there. So it's not like any of the strikers really covered themselves in glory. Marcus Thuram, we should note, comes out at halftime. That's why Arnautovic comes in. I believe the reporting I saw was that he had a tightening in his quad, was worried it could be pulled. And so that's why they had him go out, but he should be fine to play, I think, in the immediate future. So no long-term injury risk for him. I feel like Inter have this pretty comfortably in the second leg. Atleti could certainly spring a surprise, could certainly cause problems, but their XG in this one is 0.62. It didn't feel to me like they created many opportunities. That number would back that up. The thing that I was mostly concerned about from an Atleti perspective is I tend to think of them as when they are doing that, the Cholo ball, the shutting it down, the being really defensively oriented and frustrating to play against, they are a sort of like monolith almost. And with that comes an ability to retain the ball or to give away possession in okay areas, essentially. And Graham, you talked about Inter getting in behind and Inter having joy. A lot of that to me came from Atleti miscontrols and mispasses, and even the goal itself comes from a miscommunication. And then I think it's Reinildo has the ball. It kind of comes off of him because Rodrigo De Paul runs into his path. They have words after the goal is scored. But even there, to me, it's an uncharacteristic mistake. Looking at Atleti's passing numbers, I think they had 84% pass accuracy, which is their lowest in their last like seven games, several of which have been losses and draws. It doesn't seem like they're in the best run of form. It seems like they have some things they need to figure out if they want to get back into this tie.
Yeah, I would echo almost all of that. Just the exception is Atleti absolutely still have a chance in this tie. A one-goal deficit, anything can happen for this team, and they're too talented for us to count them out at this point in time. Inter, though, were the star of this game. And Taylor, that's where I completely agree with you. They were the better team by a significant margin. They controlled the game. Antoine Griezmann really wasn't a consistent threat as the lone forward for Atleti. He had Saul to one side and you know, Llorente to the other. It was a little bit of a weird setup from Simeone in a game where you know you're likely to be on the break a lot, and having a larger forward to bring Griezmann into the match, I thought would have worked well. Diego Simeone knows more about soccer than I do, but that one seemed a little bit strange to me. But Inter are so captivating, and I've been banging the drum on Inter since last season. Talked about them as the clear Serie A favorite when they were still close with Juventus. Like, this team will win the trophy, will win the title in Serie A, and has every bit they need to make a deep, deep run in this particular competition. They're still not a favorite for me at this point in time, but they are so sharp in this game and build-up. There were so many nice moments, even early on. I don't know if this happens to you guys when you take notes, where you see something happen so often that you just give up on writing it down after it's happened the first like seven times. That was Inter's build-up play in this game for me. Two great pieces of build-up in 2 minutes from the 10th minute to the 12th minute. The final ball let them down a little bit. And Taylor, that's where your point about the goal actually coming more in kind of this pseudo-transition moment, I think, is spot on. But Inter do so much good with the ball to put themselves in great spots in the final third for that final ball, assuming that their quality is going to shine through. The best moment of this game, guys, for me, came in the 18th minute. It is delicious build-up and Johan Cruyff's like fever dream. So it's Atleti in possession at first. Stefan de Vrij, playing in the middle of Inter Milan's back line, follows Antoine Griezmann, playing as the lone number nine for Atleti. Griezmann drops into midfield. De Vrij follows him in. Inter win the ball and because of de Vrij stepping forward. And then they play the ball back to Jan Sommer in goal. So now they're like set up for build-up. As Hakan Çalhanoğlu, playing as the number six, drops to the edge of his own box, which happens a lot for Inter and build-up, De Vrij just stays in midfield as not a number six, which is often where he rotates in build-up, but a number eight. Like, this was the Champions League match day of center backs popping up in midfield deep, or excuse me, like high up in midfield, closer to the center circle. And as Çalhanoğlu drops, De Vrij stays up as a number eight. Pavard then chips the ball forward out of the back line to Lautaro Martinez, who knocks it down for the center back, now playing as a number eight. And De Vrij just drives forward into the attacking half. He just goes and goes and goes. Final ball let down again. Boring, sad. I wish this had been a goal. Like, this is Inter. Like, they are maybe the closest thing that we have in the Champions League at this point. And I know Manchester City are still in the Champions League, to a positionless team. They are so fluid. Their players are so capable of popping up in different spots. And they are, even in a 1-0 game against a team that's trying to make their life difficult, a joy to watch.
Joe, why is it then that you don't have them as one of your favorites? Is there anything they could do to become one of your favorites?
If they could open a transfer window and sign Erling Haaland or okay, Kevin De Bruyne, I would probably feel... Yeah, I just don't think the talent level is there. They're the best team in Italy by a wide margin. I still think they're going to have real trouble with Man City and Real Madrid as well. I just don't see them having that top-end talent. And we saw that last year in the end of the Champions League. Like, we saw them make a deep run and just not have quite enough to get the job done. And I don't think enough has changed, even with another year under Inzaghi and another year with mostly the same core. Like, I don't think that's really changed.
Is it mostly the strikers for you? Is it the wingbacks?
It's just everything, right? Like, how many of these Inter players would start for Manchester City or Real Madrid? Maybe it's not zero, but it's not like more than two. It might be zero. Like, it just isn't quite there. And ultimately, that's not the only factor, but they're just a shade or two off for me.
I think that's fair. There is, though, Joe, I don't disagree with any of that. I look at players like Mkhitaryan as well as he is playing in this system. It feels like he's been adapted to that role rather than being a natural for it. I look at Darmian at right wing back. He's fine. He's good. But can I really envisage him becoming like a Champions League winner? I'm still to be sold on that. But James Horncastle was... Taylor sighs into the mic there. I think that might be a Manchester United related sigh. James Horncastle was on the British broadcast of this game, and obviously he focuses on Italian football. And he was trying to drive home the point that there is a real belief within Italy that Inter can win the Champions League this season. They're stronger than they were last season. That was the point he was making. I would probably agree with that. Marcus Thuram makes them stronger. I think he's an upgrade over Lukaku or Edin Dzeko, who was playing that position last season. People forget, in the final against Manchester City, they were pretty competitive in that game. You know, it took a Rodri long-range goal for Man City to crack that one open. I think they're an impressively complete team. And while last season it felt like they were still in transition with Simone Inzaghi as manager, they're now a team that can do so many different things well. They're defensively strong. They have a midfield that can control matches, but also act as a valve when attacking at pace. And they have physical threat through Lautaro and Thuram, but there's good mobility there as well. And they have width through the wing backs, and DeMarco on the left side is a bit of a clutch player. So I don't think it's impossible that they end up making a deep run, maybe even making the final if the draw falls their way. I am totally with you, Joe, though. I can't quite put them in that tier one category yet because of some of the individual compromises they've had to make.
So we're saying Marko Arnautović wouldn't get in the City lineup. Is that where we're at?
Like, where do we land on that? What do we decide?
Okay. But I mean, it's not a great leap in terms of belief, Graham. If you made the final last year, you're demonstrably better this year.
You're relying on another decent draw, though. I can't quite remember who Inter had in the quarterfinal, but they had AC Milan in the semifinals. So obviously the Milan derby, that was a difficult match in its own right, but it wasn't, you know, Real Madrid or PSG or another one of those tier one teams.
And just to be clear, I think Inter are the best team that we're going to talk about on this show. And I'm not sure it's particularly close. You look at the other set of fixtures, the ones we'll get in, I think, 2 weeks' time. Like, you got Man City on that side, you have Real Madrid on that side, you have PSG on that side, and Bayern Munich, who can still wake up at any time because their problems are not unsolvable. Inter are probably just ahead of Bayern and maybe even ahead of PSG right now when we think about how those two teams have performed.
Joe, do you remember that we're talking about the Philadelphia Union at the end of this episode?
Right, my bad. In terms of own goals, they are second to Philly. That is for sure. We know that for a fact. But yeah, I mean, they're the best team on this side as the bracket's been constructed and how they've scheduled games. Just real good teams on the other side.
Yeah. Arsenal fans, stay with us despite that comment.
Sorry, Arsenal.
From Joe. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about PSV's draw with Dortmund. Back shortly.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our Champions League review. We go now to Holland, where PSV had a 1-1 draw with Borussia Dortmund. Daniel Malen with a rocket against his former club in this one, which was cancelled out by a Luc de Jong penalty. Malik Tillman fouled in the box for that penalty. We had Serginho Dest playing for the 90 in this one. Ricardo Pepi getting an appearance. Good to see some Americans out there, Tay-Tay.
Yeah, it was. To see them out there. It was nice to see them running around. It was nice to see Malik Tillman starting in central midfield for a Champions League team in a knockout round competition. It was less nice to see him miss a very good opportunity. I'm not going to say he should have done better. I don't want to relitigate that. What I will say is I really wanted him to score that goal in the 16th minute. That is what I wanted. It's top of the box. It's a really good sequence of possession. It's really clever interplay, I think, designed to get a player in his position, so in this case, Malik Tillman, into that shooting opportunity. He takes a touch, he hits it wide, and it's just one where if he finishes that, I'm instantly like, let's get that guy in the camp. If he is starting a game for the U.S. because somebody is hurt, I am good with it. It just would have been a difference maker in terms of my understanding of Malik Tillman, and I think in his career, because he looked okay in this game. He has an engine for sure. He was the one in the 87th minute who was sprinting around the field trying to make plays, trying to win the ball back. When they would get the ball back, he's still sprinting forward. No one, I think, doubts his engine, but I don't think he had the most technically precise game.
Yeah.
I think that goes for Serginho Dest as well, who had moments where he looked sort of indecisive while dribbling forward, and oftentimes that ended in him getting dispossessed or knocked over and then calling for a foul that wasn't given. So I thought it was a really interesting game for a number of reasons, including that the Americans were involved. But I think my takeaway was I would have liked to see them do more.
Yeah, I don't think that's unfair, especially as it relates to Malik Tillman. I thought Dest or Malik, I genuinely don't know what it is. We have heard both, and I'm not sure which way to go.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be obstinate here and continue to go with Malik.
It's Stiver.
Or we'll just go Tillman. Let's just do Tillman. We don't have to worry about Tim in this particular
case. But there's two of them.
No, Tim's on the other side of the Atlantic. He's not relevant right now. We're going Tillman. I honestly don't care that Tillman misses that shot. Like, that is just not something that is important to me. You expect that if you get into good spots that eventually they're going to come over time. What I do care about, and Taylor, I don't know if you saw this or Graham, you saw this, was that consistently his first touch was pretty poor in this game. Let me back up one step.
Was there like some sort of high profile moment when that was on display, Joe? What are you talking about?
That Matt Tummels is still angry about? Yes, I'll get to that shortly. To back up, it is great to see him getting minutes in these games. Like, this year with PSV has worked out really, really well for him, and I'm glad to see him getting this level of exposure and playing this level of opposition. This is all a huge positive. His first touch in a lot of the high-pressure moments in this game was not good. I think his engine was great, finds good spots off the ball, is a decent distributor on the ball, but that is the one thing that I came away from, Taylor. You've got your shots there. I've got the first touch that I would love to see him continue to develop. And I think it will come over time as he's exposed to more of these big-time moments. But it wasn't precise. In a weird way, it actually worked out great for PSV because the goal that they score is the Luke de Jong penalty. Ryan, you mentioned it. Tillman takes a touch at the top of the box after receiving the ball, and it goes like, it honestly looked like a touch that I would take in a men's league game. Like, it was 5 or 6 feet in front of him. It was a big touch. Matt Hummels slides in my opinion, absolutely never a penalty. I do not see that being a penalty, but the ref calls it. VAR doesn't see enough to overturn it. In that process, I understand, but I do think it was a miss by the referee. And PSV have the ball in the back of the net, thanks to De Jong, and it's 1-1. I think Dortmund are hard done by there. But in general, that is the thing that I'd like to see Tillman in particular work on, is that first touch between the lines.
Graham, I don't know if I'm being too Nancy negative here, but watching this one, I felt like, do these two teams have a place in the Champions League round of 16?
Well, the weird thing about Dortmund is they've been generally very good in the Champions League. They finished top of the, you know, the so-called group of death in the group stage. This performance here, I don't know, I'm just not as warm on, I think Taylor's maybe a little bit warmer on their performance going on a running order than I am. I kind of struggle to identify what they did well on this game. And I actually thought PSV, particularly in the first half, gave them some issues. So Bakayoko gave them some issues with making those runs to the back post. His output was a little bit shoddy in those moments, but nonetheless, he's in those positions. Ryerson had his hands full with Lozano as well. I don't think Sancho had much of an influence in this game. Fulkrug seemed detached a lot of the time. Daniel Malin is on a streak at the moment. He's on a heater at the moment. He's got 5 goals in his last 5 games for Dortmund. So his contribution is obviously strong. But other than that contribution, I am kind of struggling to think of something they did well, other than maybe taking the sting out of the match in the second half. And I kind of felt that was on PSV as well, where if away goals is still a factor in this game, this was one of the instances where I kind of missed the away goal rule, because I think if that's still in place, PSV probably push harder for a second goal, and in the end it kind of fizzled out by full time. But yeah, I pass the mic to Taylor, who I think is a little bit warmer on some of the things that Dortmund did in this game.
I would emphasize the little bit aspect of that.
Okay.
I think where my Dortmund optimism is coming from is more so in regards to my PSV negativity or pessimism, because I thought they had a number of opportunities, PSV, that they could have finished. And not saying they should have done better, Joe. Not saying that. But what I am saying is that they kept getting into good opportunities that they would scuff or pass when they should have shot or shoot when they should have passed. Bakayoko has a couple in the first half and a couple in the second half. There's the Tillman one we already talked about. There's just moments where I think if there was a sharpness there, if there was more consistency there in how they were attacking and how they were kind of combining, I think they get something. Because I don't think Dortmund were particularly locked down solid defensively, as evidenced by the penalty, which I agree with Joe, probably should not have been a penalty. But I still felt like PSV were able to find moments when they could have gotten something. It's just that they failed to. And now we go back to Dortmund, where I think if Daniel Malin continues the form that you mentioned, Graham, he'll probably get one. I do feel like he is sort of like, when he wants to, can pull out these moments of magic. He has the one for the goal. He has the one in the 59th minute where it's a huge overhit ball that he somehow manages to chest control and then volley all in like one motion that I think is saved for a corner. I thought he was exceptional in this game. I thought Nico Schlotterbeck as well has like at least one play every time I watch him where he either scores or rips one from distance or goes on a 30-yard dribble through players. I feel like he deserves more credit. I feel like he should get more hype as being a very good center back who's also very attacking but doesn't seem to get that love that other Bundesliga center backs sometimes do and the big transfers that they sometimes get. So I felt like Dortmund, to your point, Graham, got the goal and then were sort of content to win this 1-0 and go back home and see the fixture out. It doesn't end up going that way, but I do think that goes a long way towards explaining some of their just slow approach to attacking in the second half and their willingness to not really be overly attacking or put themselves into situations where a sustained amount of pressure might have gotten them a second goal or even a third. I just think PSV didn't seem like they had the quality to make that difference, to close that gap. Maybe that will be different in the second leg, but in this game at least, it just felt like they were a bit profligate.
Yeah, I would agree with that. They lacked the quality at the top end of the pitch. I thought generally they did a decent job of some things like setting up traps to force turnovers. They were doing that on, was it Mattsson and Sabitzer? The press still wasn't as intense as I've seen from PSV this season. It felt like they were pressing with fewer players, but they were generally proactive in their approach. So I actually kind of saw more things I liked from PSV than Dortmund. It was just their individual quality, as you mentioned, Taylor, let them down. On the Dortmund goal, I saw Dest getting a lot of heat for his defending in that moment. I don't know what you guys think. I'm not sure there's a lot more that he could have done that moment. Maybe get a little bit closer as Malin takes the first couple steps, but I don't think he's culpable for that ball going in, although it is the deflection that puts it past Benitez in the PSV goal in the end, because the angle, he's led them on the outside, he's pushed them on the outside, he's forced them onto the right foot shot on a tight angle, and he's relatively close when that shot is made. So I kind of just put that down to bad fortune that he wasn't able to stop that one. I'm not sure there's a lot more he could have done.
I agree. I watched this many, many times trying to break it down. And the only other thing I would add, Graham, because I agree with your overall conclusion, is just that I think Saibari for PSV doesn't help in the situation. Every other PSV player seems to be sort of matched up 1v1, is either right on the person they're supposed to be marking or, as Dest is, maybe like a yard or two off. But it's that cushion because they're outside the box. You don't want to dive in. You don't want to get beat in that scenario. And Saibari comes sprinting in. He basically follows the pass to the pass to the pass and goes running all the way across. He comes sprinting in, and that's why Malin sort of drives to that end line. But I think in that moment, there's a slight diffusion of responsibility of Dest is maybe thinking, I'll hold him up. Saibari's coming in to win that ball, and then Malin takes that touch. And now I think maybe there's just a fraction of a second delay in Dest's decision-making. But even if he had acted that quickly, watching it over and over and over again in slow motion, I think it's just Malin's acceleration and that striker's instinct of, I'm taking this touch and I'm hitting it. And when you have that decision made and you know exactly what you're doing, it allows you to just do so automatically and do so very quickly, whereas the defender is always trying to react, get into a good position, and read the situation all at the same time. So I agree. I don't think there's much else he could have done. I did not love that the camera stuck with Dest as he walked away, which is what they do. They always try to spotlight the defender as everybody runs off to celebrate. He walks away with his hands on his hips, looking angry. I legit wrote curse words in my notes for the camera operator because I did not love how they were trying to paint Dest as the villain in this one. There were other reasons to be frustrated with Sergiño Dest, but not for this.
Yeah, it's funny, Taylor. I didn't have as many of those down in my notes. I liked a lot of what Dest did in terms of breaking lines to even leading to the goal, the penalty kick that PSV get that Tillman draws. But setting all that aside, I wish... it doesn't matter if it's Dest or not. I just wish that shot from Malin hadn't been deflected, because if the deflection isn't there, it is a rocket. It is like one of the best taken finishes that I've seen in a really long time. And from the moment I see the deflection, my evaluation of the goal, the score that it gets in my rating system goes down by, 50% or whatever it is. Like, it is such a strong finish. And then you see on the replay, it's deflected into the top corner. Never mind. Not so cool anymore.
All right, this one delicately poised for the return in Germany in a couple of weeks. Why don't we go to Naples, where Napoli had a 1-1 draw with Barcelona? This one will go down in history as a game of soccer between the Italian reigning champions and the Spanish reigning champions. Victor Osimhen salvaging a draw in this one after Lewandowski opened the scoring. Osimhen's first game back since AFCON, I believe. This was... Joe, how did we feel about this game? Was it good?
Taylor, what's that gif that you tweeted out from the TSS account?
Oh, it's the Simpsons, like, get ready for some soccer.
Everybody knows this gif. Passing. It's just the passing and nothing happens. Yeah. There was a lot of that to this game. First of all, before we even get into the game, Napoli are in absolute chaos right now. They have been the chaos club in Italy this season and sort of returning to that perch, really.
Joe... Anytime you can appoint your third manager who's also manning Slovakia simultaneously, you got to do it.
So they fired, as far as a recap, they fired Rudy Garcia in November. Then they fired Mazzarri earlier this week. And the replacement, Francesco Calzona, who is, as Taylor said, also the coach of Slovakia's men's national team, and is absolutely pulling double duty between now and the end of the European season. He's got the March international window coming up with Slovakia, and then is going to be coaching them at the Euro. Like, he's the guy for Slovakia, and he's
doing the good hitting, Joe, is what he's doing.
Well, he is, and we just don't see this happen anymore. And it feels to me like Napoli is very much the second fiddle in that two-fiddle race. He's not sticking around. Like, the plan is not for him to be the manager going forward. He's somebody that they're like, all right, well, guess we got Calzone in at this point. And not a lot changed tactically, frankly, from Napoli. It's not like they had some great overhaul, systemic change that was going to, you know, change their fate. It was a lot of the same tactical stuff that we've seen from them over the years, or at least over recent years. 4-3-3 shape generally, but it's very, very fluid. They'll often keep Di Lorenzo back at right back to become that right-sided center back in possession. And then Oliveira at left back doesn't always bomb up the wing like you might think if those players are kind of shifting all to the left. But he bases his positioning on where Cavaradonna is on that left side. So there's a lot of the same stuff that we've seen from Napoli. They just weren't super sharp on the ball in this game. And the same goes for Barcelona. It was the individual moments, for me at least, between two legendary strikers in Victor Osimhen and Robert Lewandowski. And every once in a while, a glimmer of hope from Pedri. And that was, in my mind, at least, how this game was decided. Or not.
The commentators at the beginning, when they were trying to set the narrative, they talked about Calzona, they talked about Osimhen being back. And then they said, I think right as kickoff happened, both teams fighting to save their seasons. Like, let's see how it plays out. And it felt more so like this was a continuation of their seasons, which was sort of disjointed, not particularly fun to watch. And at the end of it, it's like, well, I guess they're still alive. I guess we got to watch the next one. So I wouldn't say either one saved their seasons in this result, but I agree with Joe. It was cool to see Lewandowski versus Osimhen. It was really interesting to see the similarities in how they scored. It was really difficult for me to figure out exactly what Barcelona were doing, and I'm not entirely sure I have it figured out now, though it did seem to work for large stretches of this game. But yeah, I don't have a ton of notes. I definitely got a little bit bored. My notes are the type when they go from like pretty consistent up until about the 15th, and then it goes like 30, 50, 60, 75. It's about how we're going.
See, the thing is, I enjoyed this match probably the most of the four games.
You're a sicko.
Well, it's because I'm a sicko. Two bad teams. This is my jam. Like, whenever there's bad football on show, that's like moth to a flame. Yeah, this was a match between two extremely flawed teams, and we saw it in the performances that they produced. There was more to like about Barcelona's performance than Napoli's. I thought it was a strong start by Barcelona. They were pressing pretty well. Napoli, in the first like 15 minutes, were completely unable to play through the first or second line of the press. They were pegged back, and from Barcelona's point of view, Joao Cancelo was getting high on the left side, Lewandowski was getting into some good areas, making some good runs. But in that period, Napoli, there's a lot of this match where they're just the embodiment of toiling. Nothing was happening easily for them. Everything felt stilted. Nothing was happening naturally. No fluidity. One of the most frustrating things in the first half was watching how they were spending so much time looking for it felt like they were looking for the perfect crossing opportunity rather than just getting the ball in. And I know that sounds pretty simplistic, but when your centre forward is Victor Osimhen, he's a freak. That's one of the benefits of having Victor Osimhen as your centre forward, is you can put an imperfect ball into him. You can lump an imperfect long pass up to him. And a lot of the time, he'll make something of it. As I say, that's one of the benefits of having him as the number nine. He was getting very, very frustrated with the delay with the ball going into the box. So I feel like Napoli missed an opportunity there. The thing about Barcelona, though, is this season, even in matches where they're playing well, and I'm not saying they necessarily were doing that here, but they were certainly on top for a lot of this match, you know, as an opposition team, that you will get at least a 15-minute period where they drop out of it, where they get the brain fog and they get flustered and they start making individual errors. And maybe it didn't last for 15 minutes in this game, but we saw a bit of it. And honestly, it seems like it happens in every single Barcelona match at the moment. Now, it wasn't completely unprompted, because the Napoli changes in the second half, I thought, had a decent impact. Lindstrom come on off the bench, Traore came on. I thought Lindstrom in particular made a difference with his willingness to make runs beyond. Then it was Raspadori and Simeone who were introduced off the bench. And I thought there was that came at a point in the match where Napoli probably did need a bit more of a central threat, and Raspadori coming off the right side is someone who does that. So I thought Napoli certainly finished more strongly than they started it. And if they can harness some of that, I mean, Calzona, the new manager, had one training session with this team before the game, before a Champions League knockout game. So he's going to have a little bit more time with this team. I'm not expecting anything revelatory before the second leg. But if he can harness some of the stuff that they showed in the final phase of this match at Montjuic, where where Barcelona are playing their games at the moment, where they have a really poor record, by the way. Their away record this season is better than their home record, in La Liga anyway. I'm not ready to count Napoli out of this tie just yet.
Well, on that note, Graham, I was wondering if Napoli should feel even more bullish than Barcelona in the second leg for many of the reasons you've outlined there. Calzona having one training session 48 hours with the team before this game started. Presumably, he got the job, by the way, just because he still had a key card that worked at the training ground from his previous...
Because he knows Marek Hamsik, I think.
Maybe so. But, yeah, as you say, Barcelona struggling to create an atmosphere at that home stadium, a poor record there. You'd think on paper they would be fancying themselves to go through with a 1-1 scoreline away. But I just feel like Napoli, maybe with a few more of those magical Calzona sessions under their belts, they could feel like they could get something here.
Yeah, this I don't disagree with any of that. I would say that this tie could be decided on which team gets the most out of their centre forward. Because for both these teams, that is the difference maker for them, right? Lewandowski, I'm not ready to say he's truly back, because I still think some of the ways he's linking up is a little bit laboured. But his finishing has certainly been a lot sharper these last few matches. That's two matches in a row where we've had a classic Lewandowski finish. The one in this match is pretty similar to the one he scored against Celta at the weekend, where there's a quick shift from one foot to the other to create the yard of space, and then he pulls the finish back across goal. That's a Lewandowski finish. And as I say, a sharp Lewandowski makes such a big difference to Barcelona. A lot of the problems we're seeing from them this season were also there last season. It's just that Lewandowski's goals masked a lot of them. So he and maybe Lamine Yamal are the two players who could still salvage this season for Barcelona if they have a good game in the second leg. I struggle to envisage how Napoli come through this tie. Equally, if Victor Osimhen turns in a Victor Osimhen performance, then that could swing the tie in Napoli's favour. So I don't want to be too simplistic about it, but the two centre forwards really are the difference makers for these two teams.
All right. Delicately poised, as we say in this one. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about arguably the shock of the round, Porto's win over Arsenal. Back shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our Champions League review. We go to Portugal, to Joe's dictatorship in Porto, with a 1-0 win over Arsenal. Probably the shock of the round here. Not necessarily a classic game, but a shock of the round. A great strike from Galeno in, Joe, maybe a smash and grab, we could call this, with some poop houses involved.
Yeah, no, yeah. We can. As dictator of Porto, I will allow that to happen. Arsenal, well, does a smash and grab have to be a moment where, like, the opposition, the team that you are grabbing from, score or does a lot of good stuff in the attack and you just nick one at the very, very end? Or
yeah,
can
I
it
think
be?
So.
Okay, so it's not, then it's not a smash and grab, because Arsenal were not good in this game. Porto suffocated them defensively, as really we've come to expect from Porto. We knew what the general tactical approach was going to be. They were going to sit in a lower block in this match. They were going to absorb as much pressure from Arsenal as they could. And that is exactly what happened. On the whole, Porto had 35% possession. It's not them scoring early and sitting deep. It's them not scoring early, Arsenal not scoring early, and Porto sitting deep regardless of what the scoreline was. And it worked out. Arsenal really struggled to penetrate Porto's block to create chances in the final third, and Porto took their lunch money at the end. And if you're Arsenal, yeah, it's a little unfortunate, right? Because it's not like Porto had chance after chance after chance on the break. They had some looks, but you know, nothing absolutely insane for the first half at the very least. Like, you get in to the later stages of this game, and to give up one at the end hurts. But if you're Arsenal, that's what you get when you create very, very little on your own.
Yeah, if you want a hint of how this match went, there were 36 fouls in this game, which was the most in a Champions League game this season, and the ball was in play for just 50 minutes.
Oh,
That was largely down
beautiful.
to... the spoiling tactics of Porto. It was deliberate. They made this match a difficult watch, and it was really effective at stopping Arsenal from finding any sort of rhythm. They stayed compact. They put Arsenal under pressure and build up. They wanted to make it scrappy. They were okay with that. I also thought they did a good job of using the wingers to press high, but then it's those same players who are in position to block the passes into the half spaces. So whenever it went wide, Porto were well set to win it there. It was a pretty solid approach because Arsenal are so strong in the wide areas, they want to get the ball out into the flanks. And Arsenal's best opportunities came from set pieces,
yep,
which is obviously a big strength of theirs. And there's a Saliba header, which is a decent opportunity. But beyond that, it didn't feel like Arsenal really had any great ideas on how to build rhythm. They were slow to get the ball to the wide players. They did have the majority of the possession, but I thought this was one of those matches where, yes, Arsenal had more of the ball, they were more proactive, but actually it was kind of played on Porto's terms because of some of the things that they were doing.
Do you feel like that's a thing that can change? Because my assumption would be that if you have Porto then going away with the 1-0 lead, they will try to make that ball in play even fewer than 50 minutes in the return leg, and I feel like that's a thing that they are capable of doing.
Yeah, have you ever seen those videos at the like AT&T Stadium where players try and kick the video boards,
yes,
with the ball, yeah, from the? That'll be Porto trying to get it into the top tier at the Emirates for the return leg, I think.
If we kick the ball as high as we can, it's not in play. Just keep punting it straight up in the air. Nothing bad can happen.
That's great technique.
Yeah, that Ronaldinho video of him doing, yes, keepy uppies but booting it like, yes, 50 yards up in the air. Yeah.
So I did love that the goal itself, sorry Ryan, I'm just going to add, the goal itself is Galeno obviously hitting a worldie into the far side netting, the back corner. It's beautiful. David Raya at full stretch makes it even more epic. But I also enjoyed that in the maybe 20 seconds before he scores that goal, he goes to do the exact same thing. Like, he's in the same spot. He tries to drive inside and just miscontrols and then yells at a teammate for not being there for a pass when he was clearly not going to pass the ball. And then is still mid-yelling when he realizes that Porto have regained possession, and he backpedals maybe 5 yards and does it all again. And this, yeah, time it has a better result. But I love the sort of Jorginho basically being like, oh, sorry, buddy. We'll give you a second chance. Let me just kick this right back to your team and see what happens.
Yeah, it's not great game management from Arsenal in that moment.
Because
a goal is draw away to a difficult Porto team is not a disaster by any stretch. But I think it's Martinelli who kind of boots the ball from deep looking
for
Hollywood pass, trying to spring Arsenal forwards on a break when it didn't really feel like there was any need for them to do that. And then of course he gives it away. And then also Declan Rice, when Galeno takes the shot, I think he's too far away. He allows the shot far too easily. And even David Raya, I don't think it's a massive mistake from the goalkeeper, but could he move his feet a little bit quicker to get to the shot? Because you're right, Taylor, he goes like full stretch, but he's going full stretch because he's dived from the moment of the shot being taken. And it wasn't really a rocket. It was more kind of like a loopy
curler. He's got 6 defenders
curler.
In front of him, Graham, blocking his view potentially.
I think you're being kind to David Raya a little bit there, but...
Fair enough.
I think the main culprit is Declan Rice. Declan Rice should be getting closer to that shot to at least put some pressure on.
But Jorginho Dest was fine. No blame on Jorginho Dest for being
too far. No, Dest is closer. Watch it. Declan Rice is like, what, five yards at least?
Four or five. Okay, know, it's not 5 yards away. He's a few feet away from Galeno.
You just said 4 or 5.
No, you said yards. I said feet.
All right, okay.
he's not like actively blocking the shot. He's trying to make the angle more difficult. I mean, man, if we're blaming Declan Rice and David Raya as like the real culprits in this game, I think we're looking in the wrong spot. The real issue for Arsenal in this match was that they just couldn't create chances. The game, Graham, your point earlier about the game being played on Porto's terms was spot on. Like, Arsenal, yes, they had the ball. They weren't in control of the game. They absolutely were not dominating the game. They were sloppy in possession. They were sloppy when it came time to actually break through the block, either a 4-4-2 or a 4-5-1, depending on the moment from Porto. That was the issue for Arsenal. It's not their giving up a, you know, what is that shot, like 24 yards out? That's not the real issue for this Arsenal team. If you win or lose based off of that shot going in, Mikel Arteta and Arsenal should let Galeno shoot from that spot every single time. The issue for Arsenal is absolutely their inability to create in the final third.
I'm nitpicking with Raya. I'm not willing to let Declan Rice off the hook that easily. I think that's why signed Declan Rice, is to be the barrier in front of the back four. Those are the moments that you sign him
I'm not saying Rice couldn't have been closer. I guess the issue I'm taking, Graham, with your point is that I think that is like item 47 on the list of things that went wrong for Arsenal in this game. Like, if we're talking about how the match was won and lost, you know, it's a wonder strike. It is a great goal from Porto. You know, they deserve to win this match, but it's not because Declan Rice didn't get 3 inches closer on that shot. It's because they were woeful in possession.
Yeah, fair enough. Can we talk about the Galeno miss in the first half? Which is very confusing. He was the main character in this game with the two big moments involving him. But the first moment, well, it's actually a double moment in the first half where he hits the post with a shot from 6 yards out. The ball bounces straight back to him at pace and then like pinballs off him. Although it's not really a pinball moment because he does adjust his leg. It's like a shot, but he then puts it inches wide of the other post. And it was such a confusing moment because it happened so quickly. It was kind of difficult to work out what had actually happened because I think the ball ends up, you know, that way where the ball ends up behind the net. Hmm. And for a split second, you think, is it in the net? The music guy at the dugout at the stadium played the goal music. That's how much it seemed like a goal. That's how chaotic that moment was.
It was indeed. Arsenal failing to register a shot on target in a Champions League game for the first time since 2011. That was against Barcelona, peak Barcelona.
Joe's
no
face.
Less. Joe's loving the shot on target stats being levelled out here. I presume this is an aberration for Arsenal at the moment. You know, they've been in very good form since Christmas, since Salt Bae became their nutritionist, actually. So maybe they just need some more gold leaf steak to get back on target in future games. Joe, are we thinking Arsenal will get this wrapped up in the second leg, or are they in danger?
I haven't looked at the betting odds. I would be very surprised if Arsenal weren't favorites to still advance. And if you peer pressure me into picking a team, I will pick Arsenal. They're not in a great spot, though. Like, the game plan that we've talked about Porto playing in this game will be that and maybe more in the second leg over in England. So it's not going to be easy, especially given the backdrop of, yes, Arsenal have been in good form recently. Their biggest issue this year, they've been great defensively in the Premier League. Graham, you mentioned it, I think. They've been great on set pieces, like really, really good on set pieces. The consistency or lack thereof in their possession play has been the single biggest problem with this team in 2024 and dating back to the end of last year as well. So there are concerns there, but I think the talent is more likely to win out, but don't be surprised if Porto get the job done.
Good stuff. All right, that's European Champions League taken care of, Joseph Lowry. How about we go now to Joe's CCCC?
Woo! It's going to take a little bit to rebrand this. Before, we called it CONCACAF Champions League Corner or MLS Corner whenever we stuck it in at the end of a show. I think this is now, and Graham, I think you deserve credit for this title. I think this is, what, C to the fourth, CONCACAF Cup, Champions Cup Corner at the end of the Champions League reviews. It's been a hectic start to the CONCACAF Champions Cup. Vancouver Whitecaps already out for the last couple of days from an MLS perspective. We had St. Louis City topping the Houston Dynamo 2-1. That game was on Tuesday. A late goal for St. Louis City to get them the win. Houston, we mentioned it on yesterday's Western Conference preview, now potentially looking at a future without Sebastian Ferreira after they've already lost Nelson Quiñones on the left wing. They are down 3 starters, including Hector Herrera's more short-term groin injury. Not a good sign from them, but Taylor, I love how you branded St. Louis City the zombies. Like, they just, it seems like they will not be killed. Nope. Except in the playoffs by Sporting Kansas City, but yeah, I set that aside. They were zombies in this game. 2 goals in the last 30 minutes to get the job done. And then the Philadelphia Union beat Saprissa 3-2. That game was also on Tuesday. A hat trick from Julian Carranza. But the real headline, if you have not seen the own goal that Taylor and I were texting about a little bit yesterday, go watch it right now. Jakob Gleznes hits a ball that he probably shouldn't hit backwards to Andre Blake. The blame for this own goal, though, I think is on Andre Blake. Like, he completely mishandles dealing with this back pass. It's not a well-hit back pass from the left sideline for the Union, but Blake absolutely bundles this entire thing. Go watch it. It's a glorious moment in an otherwise chaotic game.
I don't remember much from my T-ball days, but I remember, get your body behind it or you're going to be in trouble. And Andre Blake tries to, like, control a bouncing ball.
What is he doing?
It's terrible.
Oh, Graham, are you just now seeing it?
I'm just, I hadn't seen this before.
Isn't it glorious?
What? It's just jumping around.
you seldom see a 50-yard own goal, but when you do, you must savor it and enjoy it, unless you're a Union fan, in which I guess you're okay. You're fine. You still won away. You
still got the result. Yeah, it is. Wow. This is football heritage. To get a 3-2 win on the road when you give up, that is maybe something that doesn't always happen for MLS teams. So well played to the Union overall. And then 2 games last night. We had the Inter-Miami RSL match in MLS play, but in CCC, the New England Revolution beat Independiente de la Correra. Probably not my best pronunciation work, but I gave it a shot. Taylor, everybody, listener, Ryan, Graham, go watch the finish from Thomas Chankalai. I have not seen this whole game. I will not admit to. I'm probably not going to have time to watch the whole thing. I hope you'll forgive me. The goal from Chankalai is absurd. He chips the goalkeeper by hitting the ball into the ground in a way that looks completely intentional to me. So he hits the ball off of his foot into the ground and over the goalkeeper. I don't think it's a scuffed finish. I think it is a deliberate attempt from Chankalai. It's a ridiculous goal. And then the last match so far, Orlando City top Calvary FC 3-0, took care of business. Duncan Maguire gets a goal. Nothing really there super noteworthy for Orlando. Just go watch the Chankalai goal. You will not regret it.
Will do. Thank you very much, Joe. Graham, I presume these CCC games were on primetime TV in the UK, like they were filling up those box parks. There was fans throwing beer in the air, et cetera, and so on.
Lol. That's all I have to say to that.
Good stuff. All right, let's wrap up this episode. Taylor Rockwell, thank you so much for your contributions on this here Champions League.
My pleasure, and thank you, Ryan Graham. I hope that you enjoyed this one and ended up with some energy and some enthusiasm for these games.
Yes, Graham Rutton, thank you very much. Energy and enthusiasm, Graham Rutton, thank you.
That was a deliberate silence. Sure. Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
Joe Lowry, thank you very much, as always, my good man, for all kinds of Champions League coverage here.
Yeah, guys, this was fun. Thanks.
Thank you very much, listener. Most of all, we'll be back on the feed very shortly. We've got a big thing coming out, all's about Inter Miami. Look out for that one. But for now, bye!